and watch Muppet Christmas Carol and Elf every year because they are just at the right age for that as well. And you know, honestly, Muppet Christmas Carol is weirdly faithful to Dickens. They take whole chunks of the narrative and whole chunks of the dialogue and put it in the mouths of, you know, just Gonzo or Kermit or whoever else. So I do love it. I just love Christmas movies. I think I sort of grade them on a curve. They are judged by a different standard to all the films I see for the rest of the year, because it's not just about are they objectively good movies. It's about do they give you that nice warm Christmassy glow.
You, Helen, have given me the excuse to say two things that I'm really not permitted to say. One is I love Dickens, and Dickens is the best. Okay, Jane Austen, Dickens, number one. And the other is, come on, Bad Santa. I need to say anything more?
Good movie. I enjoy that a lot. I think that was actually the same year that Elf and Love Actually came out. What an incredible Christmas in cinemas that was. Bad Santa's hilarious. Absolutely okay. Worth seeing.
That is it from me today. I'll be back at 1 o'clock tomorrow, but next up on Times Radio, guess who? Jane Garvey and Roy and Nika.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Good afternoon, it's 2 o'clock and you're listening to Fee Glover and Rory Nicar on Times Radio.
Jane has just got the fright of her life. coming up on the programme today, unemployment hits a near five-year high. We'll ask why and hear from business. With defence figures being hauled over the coals in Parliament today, how have we spent £6 billion only to wind up without a working tank? The undercover policing inquiry is hearing evidence from one former officer. We've spoken to the woman he had a five-year relationship with, based on a lie. And our big interview after 3:30 is with the brilliant Susie Wolfe, former race car driver and head of the F1 Academy.
But first, the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Liverpool parade attacker Paul Doyle has been sentenced to 21 years and 6 months in prison after he drove into crowds in May, injuring 134 supporters. In sentencing, Judge Andrew Menery KC told the 54-year-old his driving into the city was routinely dangerous for no reason other than impatience and arrogance. The attack was captured on his dash cam. Prosecutors say he lost his temper, with police adding it's sheer luck no one died. Judge Menery also spoke of Doyle's inexplicable and undiluted fury as he listed some of the injuries.
The physical injuries caused were wide-ranging and in many cases severe. They extended from complex life-changing harm, including multiple fractures, necrotizing infections, de-gloving type injuries, major soft tissue destruction and permanent disability, to dozens of cases of concussion, torn ligaments, significant bruising and persistent mobility problems.
Sir Keir Starmer has launched a formal investigation into foreign election interference. It's after a former senior Reform UK politician accepted bribes to promote Russian interests in the European Parliament. Nathan Gill, Reform's former leader in Wales, was sentenced to 10.5 years in prison last month after admitting accepting bribes for television appearances and speeches. President Donald Trump has filed a $10 billion lawsuit against the BBC for its wrongful edit of his speech at the January 6 riots. The statute of limitations on defamation in the UK is 1 year, which has already passed since the documentary was aired. But in Florida, where the case is being heard, it has a two-year limit. Former director of BBC TV News, Roger Mosey, still thinks Trump's case is weak.
The BBC is in a pickle over something which was originally their mistake. But I think the strength of the BBC legal case is that the case is being put in Florida, and it doesn't seem at the moment that anyone in Florida could actually have seen the programme. And also, the whole Trump $5 billion claim is based on the damage it caused to him, and he won Florida by a mile. So it doesn't look like anyone there much saw it, or that actually it had any effect on the election result.
The alleged gunman from Sunday's attack in Australia, Naveed Akram, has woken up from a coma in hospital. Sophie Ellsworth from News Corp Australia told us this update.
He'll be charged pretty swiftly, and obviously have to be questioned over this quite rapidly. We know that his father was killed in this, so that's the latest there. But they had homemade ISIS flags in their car. They had explosive devices. These are the reports coming out.
15 people died in the attack on Bondi Beach. Two injured victims have been discharged from hospital, but 22 people are still inside receiving care. And the UK has signed a free trade deal with South Korea, saving £2 billion of British exports from tariff hikes due next month. Ministers say it will also boost professional services like banking and tech by £400 million. The government's calling it a new golden age between the countries, pointing to the popularity of Squid Game and K-pop. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon, it's 2:05 and thanks for your company today. Coming up in the next 2 hours, we're going to be talking about the enduring legacy of Jane Austen. 250 years to the day since she was born, with the author and conservationist Edward Whitley. And I'll be asking, should more men be reading her? We'll also be speaking to the defence journalist Francis Tusser on why the MOD's £6.3 billion Ajax tank programme is mired in mishap, with faulty machines that are still extraordinarily not fit for purpose. Also on the show, we'll be hearing from Alison, a woman who shared her life with Mark Jenner, an undercover police officer who deceived her for 5 years and who's giving evidence this week to the undercover policing inquiry. Hers is a powerful and disturbing story. You might have heard that Donald Trump is suing the BBC for the meagre sum of $10 billion. Dorothy Byrne, the former head of news at Channel 4, will be telling us what she thinks about that. And the brilliant Dr. Rachel Ward will be here to guide us on the threat posed by the superflu and how best to protect against it. Fee, who's the big interview today?
Well, our big interview after 3:30 is with a remarkable woman, Susie Wolfe. So she is very much Formula One royalty. She remains one of the very few women to get onto the track in Formula One. In 2014, she became the first woman in 22 years to take part in an F1 race weekend. And that was because she was driving practice sessions at Silverstone and Hockenheim as well. And she decided in 2015 to retire because she was within a handbrake's reach of actually competing in a Grand Prix when one of her teammates was injured. But she was passed over in favour of a male driver and she just went, OK, I'm just going to do something else with my time. And what she's done is remarkable. So she's created F1 Academy, which is an all-female racing series. And she is pretty sure that somebody will come from that talent pool to actually stand on a podium in the next decade, because it's not a gender segregated sport. Mm. We also have a very interesting conversation about ladies' necks. So if anybody's particularly interested in ladies' necks, well, go and seek help. But
you need a very strong neck.
Yeah, that
you?
Is the vulnerable point on a woman's body that may well be the difference between being in Grand Prix and not being in Grand Prix. So we talk about that and lots of other things. She was a really wonderful woman to spend 20 minutes in the company of. She had a great energy. Mm. So I really hope that comes across in the interview. It's Susie Wolfe and she'll be on just after 3:30.
Well, this is what you're reading today on the Times website. The third most read story is activists chant long live the Intifada hours after the Bondi attack. Oxford University students and activists from your party took part in a demonstration during which the protesters chanted long live the Intifada just hours after the deadly terrorist attack on Bondi Beach in Australia. The second most read story is Trump sues the BBC for $10 billion over fake news. The broadcaster has apologised for misleading edit of the president's speech before the Capitol riot, which Trump said put terrible words in my mouth, and we'll be talking more about later with Dorothy Byrne. But the most read piece on the Times website is Royal Marine officially handed top special forces job after email blunder. The Times understands the defence secretary had previously tried to offer the post to Lieutenant General Sir Rob McGowan before anyone had been interviewed. And you can read all of those stories on thetimes.com. You'll need your digital subscription. And if you don't have one, you should definitely get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
We are 0333 003 2353 this afternoon and every afternoon, and we remain Jane and Fee at times.radio. Anything that we're talking about, we love your opinions and thoughts as we truck our way through the afternoon. Now, we're going to start with some employment figures. UK unemployment has hit 5.1%. That is the highest level in nearly half a decade. Younger workers are particularly badly off. Almost 9% of those aged 18 to 34 are out of work. The labour market has cooled over the past year, with falling employment and hiring in lower paid sectors in particular. In a moment, we're going to talk to the Federation of Small Businesses. But first, let's go to Peter Dixon, senior economist at the National Institute of Economic and Social Research. Always good to talk to you, Peter. Tell us what's led up to this, because sometimes it can feel like we're doing swings and roundabouts with these figures. Where are we in the merry-go-round at the moment?
Hi there. Well, thanks for having me on. I think the story in the UK labour market has been one of gradual weakening over the course of the last sort of 12 months. We had a situation where I think a lot of people have come back into the labour force, having been, I suppose, excluded for one reason or another post-COVID. At the same time as the supply of jobs has started to dry up a little bit. And of course, the consequence of that is we're starting to see quite a sharp rise in unemployment, which, as you said, hit a near five-year high. So a softening labour market, not a terrible situation, but not a particularly pleasant one, as the Bank of England faces up to its next interest rate decision on Thursday.
And Peter, what type of jobs are we talking about here?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, it's across the board. I mean, but the real problem is not so much the type of job, it's the type of worker. As you mentioned before, young workers are being particularly hard hit. And of course, the fact of the matter is that many of the youngsters under the age of sort of 20, I guess, got a fairly solid sort of, I think it was an 18% rise in their hourly wages back in April. And of course, that's sort of helping to price them out of the market, particularly at a time when it is alleged, I don't know how true this is, but it's certainly alleged that AI can sort of help to do a lot of the work that they were previously doing. So the younger workers face a double whammy in that sense. They're more expensive and they're also less competitive.
Alan Milburn has been appointed to provide radical solutions to the number of NEETs in particular. So those are young people who are not in education or training. Do you think that were that to be successful, that would turn the situation around? What to you is a radical solution?
Yeah, a radical solution. I mean, just create more jobs. But of course, I think back in the old days, I'm talking of the very old days, governments would have said, okay, we'll open the taps and we will create more maybe public sector jobs. I mean, but that's just not going to be done anymore, because we all know about the fiscal constraints under which governments are operating. It's very difficult to know what kind of skills to give the youngsters these days, particularly because the labour market is evolving so rapidly. But of course, what we do need is a lot more workers in the services industry to provide the needs which perhaps once upon a time being provided by workers from the EU, which have also dried up. But that's a long ongoing process. A, to give them the skills required, and B, I think the other problem is to know what skills will be required in 5 years' time. And I think that's one of the reasons why employers are being a little bit sort of cautious with regard to hiring, because it's all very well sort of hiring today, but they also have to hire with a view to where they'll be in sort of 1, 2, 5 years' time. And that, I think, is increasingly a problem for many employers.
It's interesting that you talk about that kind of manual labour job, or a job that's in hospitality or the care industry or in construction. None of those really fit the bill for graduates, do they, Peter? And increasingly, the number of graduates out of work is proving to be very troublesome. And surely it's going to be exactly that kind of young person whose job AI might snap up.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. I mean, I think a lot of sort of young workers or young graduates have come out of the university, you know, having been fed this story that, you know, it's all going to be fine and rosy once you've got your degree and you'll be fine. But the fact of the matter is they've come out with a large amount of debt. Jobs are scarce. And as you rightly say, a lot of the more highly skilled parts of the white collar market are certainly being, I don't know about being eroded by AI, but certainly they're at greater risk of being eroded away in the shorter term. So, the younger workers certainly face a number of problems. And I think what we need, therefore, is to perhaps reset the expectations of the younger generation that actually there are jobs that don't require a university degree. There are jobs in the service sector, in the trades areas, which can pay equally well and which will probably give longer term job security.
Yep. So maybe the future political slogan should be not education, and certainly not further education. We'll see how it goes down. Peter, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Let's talk now to Craig Beaumont, Executive Director of the Federation of Small Businesses. Mr. Beaumont, what are your members telling you at the moment about their feelings about employment rates and the prospects for future employment within their companies?
Well, they're really worried about costs at the moment. So if you, yeah, the government has and is about to make it more expensive and riskier to give someone a job. So we're now seeing that reflected in the stats with the fewer people working on in the payroll data. I know government claims record numbers of people in work, but that's the labour force survey, which is very controversial now due to low response rates. But the payroll data is actual data, and it shows 171,000 people less, as in a contraction in the workforce. So those are less jobs. And if you look at those that are, I agree with the previous guest about it being really about young people, it will be in April next year, 26% more expensive to employ an 18-year-old than it would have been, say, at the start of this year. So you're getting to the realms of making it a decision of, well, for the same money, I can employ four people and before I could employ five. So that makes it very difficult for a small business owner trying to cope with increased costs across the board, and employment costs remain really, really high. So that means they can't offer as much opportunities, as many opportunities as they used to.
What would you like to see happen? If somebody's listening today, and there are lots of people who listen to this programme in and around Westminster, what's the thing that needs to happen?
So I think it's about looking at the economy, thinking about small employers in particular, as to those are the people in local communities who employ those furthest from work. We're the ones who take a punt on those who maybe the CV isn't brilliant, maybe there are gaps, maybe there are non-traditional kind of choice. This is all good. We need to, how do you get more of that? And I think there's two or three things government could do. One of them is to look at the employment allowance that brings down employer national insurance for your first, at the moment, for your first four employees. But because it's not being uprated next year, it'll shrink. It'll go towards three. The second thing is this scheme they've got about paid for placements in SMEs for those furthest from work. I think that's a fantastic scheme. A bit like Kickstart during COVID, but it is aimed at young people furthest from the workforce. Well, doing that kind of scheme, I can't tell you how good it is compared to very expensive government schemes in job centres, basically employing people in order to try and employ more people. And we've always thought those are very expensive with very little results. And then finally, looking at things like sick pay. So small businesses really struggle with sick pay. It's one of their biggest costs that they say they struggle with. So we would like to look at with salary sick pay about to rise dramatically in April next year, can a small employer rebate come back? Now, if you do those three things, you do start to really hack into that high cost of employing someone. And that means we could create more jobs.
They seem to be very clear objectives there, Craig. I know that you've got to go in literally a minute's time, and we're not going to stop you because we're all about growth on this programme too. But just before you go, what was that good scheme you were referring to? Because I don't think we hear enough about that.
So the government's agreed, we were part of Rachel Reeves' announcement at Labour Party conference, to fund 55,000 placements, work placements in SMEs. So they will basically fund that placement. And Kickstart in COVID was brilliant at this. And it was basically a bit like you've got apprenticeships, you've got traineeships, but this was a paid for placement. And if you fund a young person to be in a small business, you are looking at all sorts of ways in which the small business obviously benefits, but the young person does too. It's a brilliant scheme, and we need it to start soon.
Thank you very much indeed for your time. That's Craig Beaumont, who is Executive Director of the Federation of Small Businesses. I know that lots of you listening have real first-hand personal experience of running businesses. You're listening from your business this afternoon, and we'd be particularly interested in hearing your thoughts about this and also about what Alan Milburn has been asked to do, which is a review which is aimed specifically at looking at the problems of young people who have fallen out of education. They're not in training. Those numbers are just growing all the time. And Alan Milburn has called it a downward escalator because it's taking young people into a world of benefits and a world where they just cannot see that employment is going to be for them in any shape or form. So if you've got some thoughts about that one too, we would very much like to be hearing from you. We're 0333 003 2353.
Coming up, one of the UK's most loved writers celebrates a big birthday today, and we'll blow out the candles on her behalf next. It's 18 minutes past two, and this is Fee Glover and Rory Nika on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
We're going to be joined by our friends, it says here. Friends? Charles Corran and Edwina Curry.
And the moment we've been waiting for all year long. We're going to speak to the Jorvik Viking Centre. Yes, our very favourite attraction. They've got lots in store over the Christmas period, and we're using that as an excuse to reminisce about the smelly train.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel. Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Discover Adelaide in South Australia, where culture, cuisine and natural beauty come together effortlessly. Sip world-class wines in the Barossa, stroll pristine beaches just minutes from Adelaide, spot wildlife in abundance on Kangaroo Island, and explore the magic of the Flinders Ranges and Outback. Fly to Adelaide on the new Emirates A350. Enjoy superior service and comfort in economy class, premium economy, or the refined business class. Book today at emirates.com.
Step inside our Hotel Chocolat cafes and experience the festive magic with our limited edition drinking chocolates crafted by our chocolatiers. Sink into the crisp, creamy notes of peppermint white or the delicate spices of mince pie. Topped with cocoa whip, the crowning glory. Light as air, intensely chocolatey. Oh, go on then. It is Christmas after all. Discover your new obsession, only in Hotel Chocolat cafes.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix, kitchens and bathrooms. Helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
James says there's just no point in trying to run a small business anymore. If you make money, you're a bad person. Everybody needs to give up and just go and work for the state. End up like France, James. We don't want that. If you still have a few Christmas presents to buy, we have the perfect gift. The Times Bookshop has got some fantastic titles. Whether you're a literary enthusiast, a culinary connoisseur, or someone who simply enjoys a good page turner, the Times Bookshop has got it all. Our Times Plus members will also enjoy an exclusive 20% discount. You can visit timesbookshop.co.uk or you can call 0203 176 2935. Nobody is going to remember that number. It's a really difficult to remember number. 0203 176 2935 for the perfect gift this festive season. Just type in Times Bookshop, you'll get there.
Today marks 250 years since the birth of the woman who brought us this.
I have struggled in vain and I can bear it no longer. These past months have been a torment. I came to Rosings with a single object of seeing you. I had to see you. I have fought against my better judgment, my family's expectation, the inferiority of your birth, my rank and circumstance, all these things, and I'm willing to put them aside and ask you to end my agony.
I don't understand.
I love you.
Well, so much humour in the office. Jane Austen was renowned for writing Emma, Mansfield Park, Persuasion and, of course, Pride and Prejudice, which is currently being adapted into two new TV shows. Yet despite her lasting success, she faced real financial hardship during her lifetime. While Edward Whitley, who you just heard chuckling away there, founder of the Whitley Fund for Nature and author of Jane Austen and George Eliot, The Lady Radical, is here to discuss her life and legacy. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming in, Edward.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, you've written a brilliant new book, but I want to first ask you, 250 years on today, why is she still so relevant to so many of us?
Well, can you think of a better companion to go out for dinner with tonight?
No, it's very true. And actually, I studied her at A-level. She's pretty much my favourite author.
Well, she's so universal, and she works so hard to give us all a happy ending. And I think we all deserve a happy ending nowadays just as much as we ever did.
And tell me, despite her success, she faced real hardship in her lifetime during her writing career. Why was that?
Well, she was very dependent on her brothers. Mm. She had two brothers in the Navy. She had a brother who inherited a large estate, and she had a brother who was a banker who then went bust, who we'll come on to in a minute. But then she was very dependent on them. She lived with her mother and her sister, and she had to really get their permission to travel and get them to pay for it.
Do you think that might have fed into perhaps why she was so good at writing such independent women, because she lacked that independence herself?
Yes, she was an outsider in a way. She was very observant. She was an aunt to over 31 nephews and nieces, so she had a big family, and so there's lots to watch and lots of action to think about.
Do you think she was projecting some of her wish lists of independence and the way she wished she could live her life onto characters like Elizabeth Bennet?
Definitely. I mean, she was terrified of being an old age, impoverished spinster aunt, was the expression in those days. So there's a few characters she invents, like Miss Bates, who Emma describes as being the proper subject of ridicule for young boys and girls. I mean, which is quite a harsh judgment, but those days was probably true. So she worked really hard to earn the money she earned, and she loved money. She loved earning it, and she loved spending it. She was just great fun coming up to London when she had some money and spending it and buying presents for the family.
You've talked a little bit about how, you know, good she was at writing men. We had a listener write in to say, if you just read Mansfield Park and you'll see how good she was at writing men. Do you think now, I mean, typically, I don't want to generalise here, but typically Austen is more widely read by women than men. Do you think more men should be reading her?
Definitely. I mean, it never crossed my mind not to. It's like saying, should more women read Shakespeare? I mean, you know, she's absolutely universal.
But why do you think she does appeal more to women than to men?
It's a really good question. I don't know. I think she has... she writes about the Navy very well. She writes about money very well. You know, these were male prerogatives in her day. Just looking at her brother Henry, who set up his own bank, which the Austen family all invested their money in, and then went bust. The next book she writes is the last book, in fact, called Persuasion. And that's about money has changed enormously in that time. Suddenly it's all about speculation in her early books. So someone like Darcy, he's never going to lose his fortune. Everyone's capital is secure and safe. By the time she writes Persuasion, suddenly money has become very fluid, very flexible. The family loses their money. Wentworth, you know, made his money. And so people are moving around the spectrum very widely, and she's very on top of that.
Mm. Your book also focuses on George Eliot, of course, the pen name of Mary Ann Evans, who, during her time of writing, became incredibly successful, very financially independent, very wealthy. I think she was, there's a fact that she was possibly the second highest paid woman after Queen Victoria of her day. Why, at that point, was it so much easier for a female author to earn money than it was for the likes of Jane Austen?
Well, she wrote under the pen name George Eliot, so she wasn't known to be female, and she was very careful about that. And then you've got to remember, by the Victorian time, there were printing presses, they were writing installations of their books. You know, Charles Dickens had blown open the art of the novel, so he was a massive bestseller. So it was a different world. But George Eliot wanted to write as a man, you know, under the pen name of George Eliot, about subjects which, those days, women weren't thought to be able to write comfortably about.
I mean, we had a clip earlier of one of the film adaptations of Pride and Prejudice. I think so many of us will remember, I do very fondly, from my school days, racing back on a Sunday night to watch the adaptation with MC Colin Firth and Jennifer Ely. Fantastic adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. There are two more in the pipeline. What is it about Jane Austen's work that has that enduring appeal for the big screen as well?
Well, her dialogue is so brilliant. She writes fantastically dazzling, witty dialogue. But also her plots, just when you think it's impossible for the heroine to get a happy ending, everything's going wrong. Elizabeth Bennet, think of what Darcy and Elizabeth have to get through to get to the happy ending. You've got Wickham, you've got Lydia, you've got the appalling sort of disgrace around that family. So what the clip you played earlier, yes, I mean, Darcy was right. I mean, it was really hard for him to make that proposal. But they get there just when it seems absolutely hopeless for Emma. Just in the very last turn of the Rubik's Cube, Jane Austen brings about a happy ending. And just to dig very deep, and the heroines have to dig very deep too.
Mm. Do you have a favourite Austen novel?
Well, I always feel bad saying this. I'm not Jane Austen's biggest fan. I can recognise the greatness of her work, but I'm not her biggest fan. And only because that search for the happy ending and the belief, and I went to an all-girls school, Edward, so, you know, that's the background for this. The belief that your happiness lay in the ability to end up with the right man, I just didn't want to totally and utterly buy into it.
Okay, so George Eliot is for you.
Yes, well, exactly. And I did want to ask you about George Eliot. Did more men read George Eliot simply because they thought they were reading a book by a bloke?
Yes, I think they did.
So that just tells us everything that we need to know about why men...
And about
didn't,
men.
Yes, didn't read Jane Austen. Because actually what men would find in Jane Austen is a very good guidebook as to how to not be the emotionally defunct blob in the corner who can't actually get their love positioning right. You're looking at me in such a horrified way.
All I'd say is Jane Austen shows no self-pity. She suffered enormously. You know, her health suffered. She lost her money. She lost her health. She dies at age 41. But she never shows any self-pity. She's determinedly upbeat and resilient. She never takes a backward step.
Yes.
That's pretty admirable.
Brave. I totally agree with you on that. And you know, I never want to sound completely negative about Jane Austen, but the eulogising about her sometimes I have found a little bit much, actually.
Yes, you're right. The family rewrote her history very much.
Yeah.
The Victorian times came.
And if I told you that I was a big, big fan of Fanny Trollope, would that make more sense too?
Yeah, that's great. That's great. And the Austen family tried to perpetuate a myth that she lived this spinster existence, you know, an uneventful life in Hampshire, which is not strictly true. I mean, she came up to London quite a lot. There's a lot more going on in her life underneath the surface, which you'll have to pick up in my book. But she was much better connected than the family wanted people to know.
Yeah, see, that's your book is the book that at the all-girls school in Hampshire we wanted to read.
Edward, what's the link between, I mean, you founded the Whitley Trust. How does conservation work and your work with nature connect? What's the link with George Eliot and Jane Austen?
That's an impossible question. they're parallel universes.
Right.
But I started writing this book over lockdown, and it was COVID, and I was reading my rereading my favourite authors, and Jane Austen's obviously top of the list, George Eliot second. And I started writing essays about them, which I shared with my daughter, who was in Paris. And Honor was very forgiving and kept writing back and saying these were good. So the essays got longer and longer. And so that morphed into the book.
Well, happy birthday, Jane Austen.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us. And I must just say, Victoria has messaged in to say, I'm 72. We did Middlemarch for A-level. In truth, I'd have preferred Pride and Prejudice. Well, I did do Pride and Prejudice for A-level, and it was a joy.
Fantastic.
More thoughts on Jane Austen, please, would be lovely this afternoon. 0333 003 2353. We're just gone 2:30. Coming up, why tanks costing £6 billion have turned out to be totally rubbish. We'll get the news headlines first with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. A man's been jailed for 21 and a half years for driving into crowds of Liverpool fans during their Premier League victory parade. Paul Doyle injured 134 people in May, including children. A court heard the attack only ended because a former soldier climbed into the back seat and put the automatic gear stick into park. Prosecutors call Dan Barr a hero. He says the attacker kept repeating, "Why won't they move out of my way?"
I was obviously aware that it was horrendous. I could see people's faces, they could see the looks of just like they were trying to plead but wasting their time. That's all that they could do. There was nowhere to go, there was nowhere to get out of the way.
A 9-year-old girl has been found dead in Weston-super-Mare in Somerset. A teenage boy has been arrested. An urgent review has been launched into foreign interference in UK politics. Nathan Gill was jailed in November for making pro-Russian statements in return for tens of thousands of pounds before becoming Reform UK's leader in Wales. David Norris, one of Stephen Lawrence's killers, has been denied parole. The 49-year-old was jailed for life with a minimum term of 14 years and 3 months in January 2012. health, almost 20 years after Stephen was stabbed to death in a racist attack. The BBC's confirmed it'll defend itself against Donald Trump, who's suing over an edit in a documentary. The US president claims he was portrayed in a defamatory, deceptive and malicious manner. And a number of Dubai-style chocolate products have failed UK food standards. Anyone with allergies is told to avoid them. And for News Bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
This is Times Radio.
Christmas was a tough time in my family. I became homeless as an adult. I had to turn to a food bank.
This Christmas, your gift to Trussell could help provide emergency food and expert advice. For people like Aaron, it'll be a lifeline.
This Christmas, my dream is that people leave the food bank with hope.
If you can, please give to Trussell today. You can help food banks provide an emergency food parcel and support someone facing hunger this winter. Search Trussell today.
This Christmas, McDonald's and the Elf on the Shelf are bringing festive tasks to your little ones, like writing a Christmas card for your postie.
Thank you. You're one happy helper.
Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 30th of December, from 11 a.m, includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last, subject to availability, fair ordering policy applies.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix, kitchens and bathrooms. Wix local design experts are ready to help. Whether you start with an in-store design consultation or with a free home measure, it's completely up to you. Find out more about the free design service at wix.co.uk.
John Pienaar joins us at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Hello, John.
Hi, Fee. Hi. There's lots on the show today. Do you remember the state visit of President Trump to Chequers, Windsor Castle, all that sort of stuff?
Remember it well, John. It was, remember it well.
Lots of fanfare. And Keir Starmer looked very pleased to be sitting in that marquee at Chequers announcing this £31 billion tech trade deal. Well, maybe he was smiling too soon, because America has kind of frozen the entire thing. They've put down new demands for Britain to give more on trade, including looser food standards in imports of American food. And they don't like digital taxes. They don't like digital regulation. And now that all of that is in the way of this deal actually going ahead. So we're going to be talking about that and more broadly about the, you know, the Downing Street are calling this hardball, you know, suggesting it's the normal way of doing business. But, I mean, they did think they had a deal. Now it turns out that they don't, and you know the muscle of the White House is coming to bear again. So we're going to be looking at that uncomfortable reality, the Ukraine, where there's more lot of upbeat chat coming out of European leaders and the American side as well about maybe getting closer to a deal in Ukraine we've ever been, but are we? Or are we just on the same old merry-go-round? Looking at the BBC and the new funding settlement, which is the search for that, has now begun. And I'm talking to the Justice Minister, Jake Richards, about tougher sentences for those who've murdered a police or prison or probation officer.
John, thank you very much. John takes over from us at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Now, the problems with the Army's new Ajax armoured vehicle are on glaring display today as defence figures give evidence to Parliament. Leaks about the dangers of the £6 billion programme have emerged on social media, while multiple soldiers have been invalided out of the forces or hospitalised after testing the vehicles. This is all despite assurances from ministers that issues with vibration and noise were very much in the past. Well, let's talk to a man who knows his stuff about this. Francis Tusa is a journalist and the editor at Defence Analysis. Francis, can you set out more for us what the problems with Ajax actually are?
Well, you mentioned noise and vibration. It is particularly noisy, noisier than many other vehicles of its type. And you always get this excuse of, oh, all armoured vehicles are noisy and vibrate. Yes, and then there's Ajax, which is in a different category of all its own. And the vibration has caused, if you remember, Fee, white finger syndrome, which miners suffered from using pneumatic drills. It's caused aspects of that, but also the vibration can cause problems with the inner ear, again, causing problems with balance and deafness. Highlighted by the only person who will come out of this programme with any credit, the commander of the Armour Trials and Development Unit down at Bovington in Dorset, Colonel Page. He spoke truth unto power and said, my troops are getting injured, we need to stop. He was repeatedly told, no, we want to press ahead. And yes, it has caused people being invalided out of the army. It's an army program. I suppose the thing was we'd been told this was all sorted, and then suddenly it turns out the trials, which myself and a colleague published about 3-4 weeks ago, trials with the army, the infantry in May, June, they were experiencing all the same problems. And then Larissa Brown, defence editor of the Times, got stories that just before the minister, Luke Pollard, stood up and said, this vehicle is safe, there are exercises with similar injuries. So it looks as if the solutions found to noise vibration didn't work.
How come an armoured vehicle can get as far as being used by personnel without it having been road tested and exactly these problems being identified?
Well, the problems were identified in sort of 2019-2020 down at the Armour Trials and Development Unit, and it was reported up the chain of command, and the programme was halted, absolutely halted, whilst they worked out, A, what the problems were. And vehicles had loads of measuring devices put on them, driven around test tracks. And then, and again, I was wrong, a solution was never found. Mitigation was found. And, of course, mitigation is not a solution. So we shouldn't then be surprised that an engineering solution was never implemented, there are still problems with noise and vibration. And I think one of the problems is in several of the reports about the whole Ajax fair, they highlight the fact that people, with Colonel Page aside, did not pass information up the chain of command. And even if they did, it tended to be ignored.
Right. We live in modern times, though, don't we, Francis? And people have access to social media and, you know, people have a stronger voice than perhaps they have done before. We have the Hillsborough Law now as well. Can you tell us what impact all of those things have had on all of this?
Well, the fact that we have had mass leaking of videos, photos, documents on social media, and I will especially, as we're, do a shout out to the Twitter handle Fill Your Boots, who's done an absolutely amazing job. Basically, the army has lost control. And they don't understand that they can threaten as much as they like. But you mentioned the Hillsborough Law. I think a number of people have forgotten that there is no such thing as Crown immunity anymore. So someone in the chain of command saying, I was doing this because I had been ordered and anyway I'm protected from being sued, doesn't exist. And so a mixture of the rise of social media, end of Crown immunity, and then the Hillsborough Law, which, you know, prevents corporate cover-ups and you can be prosecuted. You know, we're not in Kansas anymore, Dorothy.
Yes, okay. And it is a huge amount of money as well, isn't it, Francis? And I mean, somewhere along the line, that always plays out, doesn't it? The person who's, you know, signed off a £6 billion programme doesn't want to be the person who has to go and say, oh dear, that's £6 billion down the drain. I mean, do we have any particular names or areas of investigation on that side of this?
Every major programme inside the Ministry of Defence has a senior responsible officer. This is a person, and the letters of commission are published. They're on the Ministry of Defence website, and it lays out the terms of reference of that individual and what their responsibilities are. And it tends to be, you know, delivery of programmed time to cost with certain capabilities. Ministry of Defence at the moment are playing a little hard and fast, refusing to release the names of all of the individuals who are appointed as the Ajax senior responsible officer. Because if I'm the House of Commons Defence Select Committee, if necessary, I subpoena every single one of those, one after the other, and you just ask them, what did you know, when, who did you tell, and what did you do?
Yeah.
You start there, and you then work off that. If necessary, a bit like some weird crime drama, you have a huge whiteboard with bits of string connecting newspaper articles, and you just go through the whole history of this, I would say, probably since about 2014.
And if you have a car that vibrates and makes you feel ill, you'd be able to take it back to a garage, wouldn't you? And ultimately, you'd be able to say, I'd quite like my money back on this. I just can't use the thing. Can the army, can the ministry ever get the money back?
Simple answer, no. You have to ask Another question, say, the House Commons Defence Committee can ask is, how come you have this massive multi-billion pound programme? It has missed five in-service dates, and the company responsible, General Dynamics, has not had to pay a single penny in damages.
Right, that seems extraordinary.
Yeah, well, you know, normally speaking, any contract will have penalty payments, damages clause and so forth. And this question has been asked in Parliament. You can search it on Hansard. General Dynamics has not had to pay a single penny in damages. So how is that the case?
And has Ajax been bought by other countries for their military?
No, and it won't be. I've heard things of, oh, Estonia is going to buy it. No, they're buying something else. I've heard Poland's going to buy it. Well, I was speaking to a Polish journalist earlier today who basically spat coffee out when I asked him this, and he just said, we've got our own perfectly successful armoured fighting vehicle. Why would we want to buy it? And then it was a bit of an extreme invective I won't use. This thing you've got, which doesn't work. This basically, especially with all of the videos from troops coming out, Ajax as an export program is a pariah.
Well, thank you for explaining so much about this story. That's Francis Tusa, who's a journalist and the editor at Defence Analysis. It's a £6 billion program, delivered something that cannot be used by personnel without it making them unwell, being sent to hospital. And I remember the white finger syndrome. So that's when you've had vibration running through your hands or your bones so much that you completely and utterly lose the feeling in all of your fingers. You lose the blood supply to the tops of your fingers. That's not going to work on the battlefield, is it? We are enjoying your company this afternoon. Thank you very much indeed for all of your thoughts. Just to go back one story, Duncan says, why is it that you always assume that all men are emotionally bankrupt, selfish? And then we use words there, Duncan, that we can't say out loud on the radio. It's not at all. I don't think that at all. But I think, Duncan, you have to admit that Darcy is a hero who rides the emotionally tongue-tied thing. Mm. That's just what he does. That's the whole point. He can't actually declare his love openly. He can't describe his feelings. He's always incredibly caught up in something, and that prevents him from finding love right until the very last minute. So that was what I was referring to there. Not all men, hashtag, not all Jane Austen heroes.
I think Duncan should get stuck into some Austen and he might feel better about life. It's just my hunch.
Duncan, keep us posted. That's a personal challenge there from Roya.
Coming up, super flu, super bad. Health news is up next. It's 2:45. This is Fee Glover and Rory Nika on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
With eyes on the possibility of a finalised peace plan for Ukraine, the UK Defence Secretary John Healey co-chairs a virtual meeting of the Ukraine Defence Contact Group with his German counterpart Boris Pistorius. The government have launched a review into the amount of young people out of work. We'll examine how big the problem is here in the UK, and the biggest stories of the day will be expertly thrashed about by the journalist and broadcaster Colin Brazier and the author Rebecca Reid.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio. Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia. And we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
This festive season at McDonald's,
get rich deals every day.
Okay, okay. With a sausage sandwich for just...
Let's see, 99 MP.
Six chicken McNuggets for just...
99 MP.
Fine. Get Grinch deals every day
in the McDonald's app.
18 plus app only. Ends 24th of December. One use per offer. Fees apply to delivery. Participation varies. T's and C's apply.
Christmas on Times Radio.
you'll likely be aware of, if not a victim of, the so-called super flu currently circulating. The new strain is officially called H3N2, and it's presenting the NHS with a tidal wave of illness, according to health bosses. Last week, the number of people admitted to hospital with flu rose by 55%. Well, Dr. Rachel Ward is our resident GP and co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast, and she's here to talk us through what's going on. So, Rachel, amid all the conversation circulating around doctor strikes, it's quite hard to cut through the noise on this. How bad is the situation on the ground and on the wards with this new super flu?
Good afternoon. Yes, I mean, this is a serious situation with flu. We know, you know, we've discussed this for the last few weeks, that flu, I think we can be very flippant about it. And every year, flu kills thousands of people in the UK. And we have seen a bit of a perfect storm this year. So we have seen an early peak in cases, and we have seen pretty poor uptake of vaccine. We've struggled to get our flu vaccine uptake to good levels since, you know, the peak of COVID, really. And we're certainly seeing the effect of that. So we've seen a lot of children with flu, and there's been huge numbers of children off school. And we're seeing cases then rise in the rest of the community, which obviously adds pressure to all elements of the health service. So yes, you are absolutely seeing beds taken up by people with flu, and that, you know, really swamps services. But certainly in general practice, we are incredibly busy with people coming forward with these winter bugs. And it's really tricky times.
Do we know what is causing the vaccine reticency since the COVID pandemic? Why are people reluctant to go and get their flu jabs?
I think there's really a mixture, and it's not just flu. We have really struggled with getting good rates of coverage for our childhood immunizations, MMR, for example. We've really struggled across the country since COVID. I think people were so overwhelmed by all of the discussion and the pressure of vaccination during COVID. There is just this real kind of vaccine fatigue. I think alongside that, we have seen a huge amount of coverage on unreliable sources, you know, on social media, with kind of poor advice, to be blunt, about vaccines. And this really spreads very rapidly, and it has led a lot of people to have doubts about why they should be vaccinated, which is really worrying and dangerous.
If people do go and get their flu vaccine this year, what are the figures showing in terms of how effective that vaccine is against this new strain?
Well, I don't think we have really clear, you know, we never know until the end of the flu season, really what our overall outcome is. But we know, you know, we look at the Australia figures every year, where we base our vaccine on that. And we know at the moment that it is looking like it is giving some good levels of protection. It will vary every year, but what I can say is that it is certainly giving you some protection against serious illness. And that in particular is for vulnerable people. I was really shocked. I had a look at the uptake figures before coming on. I was really shocked to see that only 35% of pregnant women have had their vaccine. You know, and this is a group of, you know, just one cohort that can become incredibly unwell with flu. So I can't stress enough how important it is to go and get vaccinated.
That is a real worry. In terms of hospitalizations for flu, we normally see the peak of that into January. Why is this happening a month earlier than normal?
So we know that there are certain properties with this strain, H3N2, you know, that the virus mutates every year, and that mutation changes the way that it's passed between different people and how virulent it is. And so we know that that has kind of led this kind of early peak. And again, that element of having low uptake in children and then cases, you know, spiraling in the school place before Christmas holidays, etc. So multiple different factors which can lead to that high peak.
You talked about very, very low uptake of the vaccine from pregnant women, which is obviously very concerning. But also, less than half of NHS staff have had their flu vaccines.
Yes.
Why? Why so few?
Yeah, also, really worrying figure. So we're at about 43% of uptake in NHS workers, of frontline NHS staff. You know, and everybody is offered a vaccine. In the peak of vaccination, which was during COVID, we got about 75% vaccination rate. Look, when I get offered a flu vaccine every year, I see that as a privilege because it's a way that I can access it. If I didn't get it through work, I would absolutely go out and seek it privately because I think it's so worthwhile. Mm. I think it represents multiple things. Of course, just because you work for the NHS, it doesn't mean you don't have the same external influences and that kind of vaccine fatigue. I also just think it's one of those representations of just a kind of low staff morale and just feeling, you know, negative about the workplace, which is really sad. I think it's a complex situation, but worrying.
We've had a message in from a listener, Helen, who says, I had my flu vaccine quite early. Does that make it less effective if I get the flu now?
So the flu vaccine does give you good coverage for a few months. So if you had it, you know, we start doing ours kind of September, October, and we know that you'll get good coverage through that flu period. So that is fine.
A couple of other listeners have messaged in, actually, which something I came up against. I was offered a flu vaccine because I have asthma. And when I called my local GP surgery a month ago, so they had completely run out. And a few of our listeners are messaging in saying they've wanted to get vaccines, but they haven't been readily available at their local GP. I was able to ring my local pharmacy and go and get one. What's the situation on the ground in terms of vaccines? Is there a shortage of them or are there enough to go around?
So I certainly in my area, I have not come across any shortages. I think what's happened is more and more the vaccination programs, particularly COVID this year, has moved into community pharmacies, just one of the services which we're being encouraged to move into the community to kind of open up access to other GP services. And so we did our flu vaccinations really quite early. And we're not really doing that much now because we're doing other work. And so people, you know, may find that they're not able to anymore get it at the GP, but absolutely community pharmacies are doing plenty. If you can't, you know, pop into your local pharmacy, you can Google it on NHS flu vaccine and you can call 119 and they will advise you where you can go locally.
Of course, all of this surge is happening at a point that we are about to have doctors going on strike from tomorrow for 5 days. Rachel, what is your assessment of the impact that is going to have?
It's an interesting one. I'll be very honest and say I've had very mixed feelings all along about the resident doctor strikes. I have a huge amount of sympathy for their situation. I think they are underpaid and I think the situation, the work environment that they work in is totally unacceptable. This week, I've also had sympathy towards Wes Streeting taking on a challenging situation and trying to make some pretty big improvements, you know, and often finding himself up against it with big changes. This week, I will say I've found it very frustrating that there's been a kind of political rhetoric almost trying to scapegoat the junior doctors that, you know, the winter pressures, the flu pressures that we're seeing is down to them going on strike. And I can tell you that I cannot remember a winter where we have called it a winter crisis in the NHS. And certainly, I suspect it will be the case for coming years. These 5 days, they will be challenging, of course. But patients are in good hands of consultant colleagues. There are changes to services which can be made to make it safe. And I think it's incorrect to say that poor outcomes will be due to junior doctors going on strike. I think, yet again, it is an example of where junior doctors are expected to work through incredibly difficult conditions and all healthcare professions over the Christmas period. So, yeah, probably quite a strong opinion on that one, but I have found it difficult for some of the things that have been said about it this week from the government.
Nothing wrong with strong opinions on this programme. I was watching Wes Streeting yesterday, who seemed to be struggling with his words when he kept being asked whether or not it was actually going to have an impact on people's lives, the doctor's strike and the flu surge we are seeing. There's a little bit of good news amongst all this doom and gloom and the super flu, Rachel, isn't there? Because vape sales, we learn, have plummeted following a government clampdown on disposable devices. And this is something that's particularly rampant, the use of vapes amongst young people. Increasingly, I see so many young people and my friends' children using vapes, but apparently a little bit less. Tell us more.
Yeah, this is fascinating. So the ban into single-use vapes came in earlier this year, and there's been a 13% decrease in spending on vapes. We do know that, you know, it's the younger people, teenagers, that are more prone to using the single-use vapes. So on the surface, this seems like good news. We do not want children, we do not want young people to be taking up vaping. Vaping was originally designed as something to get you off cigarettes. So we do not want young people to be vaping. My only slight concern about this is I think we're not getting the full information here. So how many people are buying disposable vapes kind of on the black market type picture? And also, is it that trends are changing? Certainly, I'm seeing a lot of young people now using things like nicotine pouches, which are equally really, really bad for you and a bad habit. So I just worry that though on the surface there's some good news here, what is the full underlying picture? But certainly one for us to continue to follow.
Do we think more people are going back to smoking if less are using vapes?
I'm not sure if there is evidence of that at the moment, but again, certainly something that we need to be aware of, because that obviously would be even worse than vaping.
I'm just going to read out a message we've had in from a community pharmacist based in Warwickshire who says, we've been vaccinating since the start of October. However, we've been able to get hold of the vaccines over the last 2 weeks. So it does sound like that there could be a bit of a shortage on the ground. But the advice is, as you say, Rachel, go and get your vaccine if you can. That is Dr. Rachel Ward.
So many of you are texting us this afternoon to say you've already tried to get your flu vaccination and you can't get it from the pharmacy and you're being delayed on GP appointments. So there's obviously a few bumps in the system happening. Stay safe if you can. And Duncan's diving into Jane Austen. Well, bonnets on, Duncan. Keep us posted.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
There's nothing more frustrating than wanting a vaccine, knowing you're eligible for a vaccine and not being able to get hold of a vaccine. It's a little bit of a throwback, isn't it? It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Roy Anika on Times Radio. In the next hour of our programme, what is it like to discover your relationship was based on a lie? The undercover policing inquiry is hearing from former officer Mark Jenner. We've spoken to the woman he deceived for 5 years. Donald Trump wants a mere $10 billion from the BBC. Over that panorama edit. The Lib Dems want the government to fight back. We'll hear from them. And Dorothy Byrne, news maven of legend, will talk to us about the future of the BBC. And our big interview after 3:30 is with the former racing driver Susie Wolfe on running the F1 Academy, her life, and who we should watch out for on the podium. First, it's the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. A former Marine has been sentenced to 21 years and 6 months in prison for injuring 134 Liverpool fans on what should have been a day of celebration. Paul Doyle drove his car into a Premier League victory parade in May, hitting people of all ages, including a pram. Police say his rage and loss of temper was picked up on dash cam footage. Detective Chief Inspector John Fitzgerald says it makes for horrific viewing.
In my 20 years of police service, this is the most distressing and graphic footage that I've come across. You can see people in front of his vehicle and Doyle has got complete disregard for their safety. He continues to drive as people bounce off his bonnet.
A review has been launched to look into how foreign money is influencing British politics. It comes after Reform UK's former leader in Wales was jailed for accepting bribes. Local Government Secretary Steve Reid told MPs Nathan Gill was taking money to further Russia's interests.
A regime which forcefully deported vulnerable Ukrainian children and killed a British citizen on British soil using a deadly nerve agent. This conduct is a stain on our democracy.
The findings from the independent investigation are expected by the end of March. The BBC says it will fight a defamation case brought by Donald Trump that could cost the corporation billions of pounds. He claims a Panorama programme edited clips from 2021 to make it look like he urged supporters to fight at the US Capitol. Former director of BBC TV News, Roger Mosey, says the BBC could have done more since it was first known about in January of this year.
I think the BBC could have got ahead of this. It's perfectly possible they could have issued a statement saying, look, we got this edit wrong, but we stand by the programme. And that would have been a much shorter damaging news cycle than eventually being forced into a position where they had to apologise and go for the whole crisis that has unfolded in recent weeks.
One of Stephen Lawrence's killers has been denied parole and is staying in prison. David Norris murdered the 18-year-old during a racially motivated attack in southeast London in 1993. During a public hearing in October, the 49-year-old admitted his role for the first time, though refused to say who else was involved. Stephen's family had opposed Norris's release. And the UK signed a free trade deal with South Korea, saving £2 billion of British exports from tariff hikes due next month. Ministers say it'll boost professional services like banking and tech by £400 million. The government's calling it a new golden age between the countries. Dr. Edward Howell, a lecturer in international relations at Oxford University and a career specialist, explains the significance of the deal.
It marks a long-term process of negotiations and renegotiations, particularly after the UK left the European Union. It highlights very clearly how South Korea is a vital economic partner for the US. I mean, it was only until the end of June this year, the UK exported just over $8 billion worth of goods and services to the Republic of Korea.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It's Fee Glover and Ryan Nika with you this afternoon for the next hour, taking you up to John Pienaar with his Drive show. In the next half an hour, we're going to talk about Trump versus the Beeb. And after 3:30, Susie Wolf is on the programme talking about Formula One and also weak necks.
Weak necks, well. Former police officer Mark Jenner is giving evidence to the undercover policing inquiry about his time infiltrating left-wing groups. Whilst deployed against the Colin Roach Centre in Stoke Newington, he entered into a five-year relationship with a woman we're calling Alison. They lived together, went on holidays together, and attended gatherings as a couple, all while he was undercover and married with children. Well, I spoke to Alison earlier and I began by asking her how it feels to see Mark Jenner giving evidence under his own name this week.
In some ways, I try to look at the positive. It has smashed any of those illusions and perhaps idealised romantic memories I have from when I knew him 25, 30 years ago, when he was a noble anti-fascist, anti-racist trade union activist. He is now very much a police officer and very, very much a member of Special Branch, and it's been quite helpful in that way. It's also been very disturbing because he's very angry. He's angry at being held to account. He's uncomfortable. He's very irritated, I think. And he's, you know, slinging quite a lot of mud wherever he can.
And what have you made of the evidence that he's given so far?
Some of it chimes with, you know, memories I have. A lot of what is being asked about at the moment is with groups that I wasn't involved in. Mm. So I don't know whether that's accurate or not. Going by some of the evidence of other officers, and also the documentation relating to me, or rather lack of it, they are often full of fictional reporting. So I really have no idea how accurate or honest some of his responses are. There are some things he's saying that do chime with my memories. However, I think the big takeaways at this stage for me are that yesterday he was asked about his relationship with me very, very briefly, and he said it was necessary. And that was one of their mottos, the SDS, the Special Demonstration Squad, which was this so-called elite unit within the elite unit of Special Branch. Their motto was, by any means necessary. So he is arguing that his relationship with me was necessary, and he has absolutely no remorse. We were just hearing evidence earlier about a death threat that he received in the middle of the night when he was living in my flat. And David Barr KC asked him, well, that must have been disturbing for Alison. How did you feel about that? And his response was, it was disturbing for me. So I think we're seeing a man with very little empathy and no, well, I think non-existent empathy, actually, and no remorse.
I mean, it must be incredibly painful to hear a five-year period in your life where you shared your life with a man and, as you have said, loved a man, described by him as necessary, a necessary deception. Can you just tell our listeners a little bit about the group that he was spying on, the Colin Roach Centre? Explain to us a little bit about what it did and your involvement with it.
Yeah, the Colin Roach Centre was a non-aligned political group in Hackney. It was named after a man who was killed in contact with the police. The group was a campaigning centre. It supported local activity, local grassroots community politics. It supported campaigns by members of the community. Many of those were about police accountability and police criminality in Hackney at the time. Hackney Police Station in Stoke Newington was known to be have a lot of corruption and corrupt police officers. And the precursor to the Colin Roach Centre was something called the Hackney Community Defence Association. And that had exposed some of that police corruption. We were also involved in anti-fascist and anti-racist politics and trade union politics. It was a campaigning group. There was also a lesbian and gay group. I mean, but Mark went on to survey other groups as well. The Colin Roach Centre was his starting point. And in terms of the pain of hearing about this, to be honest with you, I had a lot of pain and a lot of trauma 25 years ago when he disappeared. When he disappeared, it was very upsetting and very traumatic, and it was a very dark few years. Where I sit now, I sort of expect little else. I've watched this inquiry from the outset. I've heard evidence from a number of undercover police officers who had deceived women into abusive sexual relationships. And they operate like a gang. They cover each other's backs. They don't tell the truth, or they evade the answer. They evade answering questions. And their primary, I'm talking about this unit specifically, their primary concern is to protect themselves. It's about self-interest, and self-preservation.
Can I ask, in terms of how you first came to meet Mark, how he came into your life and then how he disappeared, can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because there was a point where you originally thought he was someone else and then you discovered he was a police officer.
Yeah, he joined the Colin Roach Centre. He was brought along to a meeting. He'd gone to a Black Justice meeting that I hadn't attended, and then a member of the centre brought him along to one of our meetings. We started going out pretty soon after he arrived. I fancied him. Of all the things, I have said this, of all the things I accuse him of, being predatory wasn't one of them. I fully imagine, in the evidence we're going to hear later today, he will be saying all sorts of misogynistic things, or tomorrow, misogynistic things about promiscuity on the left and, you know, women, you know, these females, he called us yesterday, females who he had to, you know, he had no choice. He was only human after all. There were women falling at his feet. That's what happened to the left. So that's how I met him. And then 5 years later, I mean, you know, it's worth really kind of emphasising that. And we lived together for four of those years. And really most of that first year he lived with me because his property was really not very nice. And he was married with children, I later discovered. So we've written a book called Deep Deception. In its first iteration, it was republished as paperback as The Undercover Policing Scandal, Love and Lies Exposed. And there's a documentary still on ITVX about the discovery. Because, yes, we had these relationships, myself and now 68 women. But in the first case that we brought, there were eight of us. And of that eight, several of us basically turned detective. You know, our men disappeared. We were heartbroken. They seemed to be traumatised with childhood trauma, and it didn't make sense. And in my case, I became quite obsessed with finding him. I was first, in the first instance, I was just worried about him, really worried. later, after a few weeks, I started to suspect that he was some kind of undercover operative. And then I became obsessed, and that's when I think I was probably not very well. Well, we know I was not very well. But I was right, and that impacted on many of my relationships because people, understandably, thought I was mad. There was me saying, you know, my ex-boyfriend was an undercover operative working for the state, spying on us. And their answer was like, what do you mean? You know, my brother, I've said this several times in interviews, my brother was like, you know, you're a pain in the backside. He left you. That's why he left you. You don't need to construct some James Bond story. And, you know, what was so significant about your little group? What were you doing? The kind of, you know, the position that people put women in who have been raped in a conventional sense. You know, what did you do to deserve it? Did you walk down that alleyway with a short skirt? What did you do to disturb it? First, they don't believe you. And then when you convince them that it's true, then you obviously brought it on yourself. And the reality is that the test, the assessment for undercover policing is whether it is the surveillance is necessary and proportionate. And what we're seeing in case after case after case is that it was unnecessary and completely disproportionate. But even if it had been necessary and proportionate, even if, you know, any of us were committing serious crime, I mean, I absolutely was not, but even if I had been, it would still be absolutely unacceptable, we argue, to have engaged me in a deceitful sexual relationship because I didn't give informed consent, and we know what that's called.
And of course, it's not just your life that has been immeasurably impacted with that deception. Do you have any idea as to what his own family, his wife and his children have made of that level of deception?
So I think he is particularly angry. What I'm seeing today and yesterday, I think he is particularly angry about the fact that his wife and I have met. She reached out to me via her lawyer a while ago, and we met several years ago and have created a very strong bond. I have the most enormous respect for her. She is a woman of huge empathy, of great integrity, and has been incredibly brave in coming forward and giving evidence to the public inquiry. And she put her life on hold. She gave evidence last Tuesday. She put her life on hold for 5 years in the understanding that he was doing really important work. And what we're seeing in the inquiry so far is that it doesn't look like he was doing very much. I mean, it looks in some ways, he's made it, tried to look like he was, you know, surveying really dangerous people and, you know, real baddies. They've created this upside down world where many of the people, and I'm talking now specifically about the people at the Colin Roach Centre and other groups that were surveyed by other officers, many of the people were engaged in progressive politics, campaigning for a better world. And what they've done is turn the victims into the offenders. They're making the way that Jenna's evidence is coming out, it's as if somehow he's the victim here. And the people who were involved in that grassroots politics are being presented now as, you know, dangerous. And the officers who were surveying these people were, you know, they were the ones who deserve respect. And it's a very upside down world.
Well, that is the extraordinary story of Alison, who had a 5-year relationship with Mark Jenner while he was deployed against the Colin Roach Centre in Stoke Newington, and the inquiry is ongoing.
We were just perusing this story in the studio as the tape was going out, and I think you're absolutely right, Roy, to plant in people's minds the first meeting that any of these undercover cops would have had with a boss who said, look, here's the plan. We're going to send you in, and if you have a relationship, well, that's all to the better. And if you were to have a really serious relationship, that's absolutely fine. And everyone sitting in the room just goes, yeah, that's a great plan. I'm going to embark on that. I mean, you know, the emotional damage was obvious to everybody from the get-go. It didn't develop. It was there in plain sight. That's what the operation was. It's such a distressing story.
It's extraordinary. And you were making the point that, as far as we know, there aren't any undercover police women. Who did this?
Who were asked to go and have relationships with men. No, they weren't. But, you know, let's not get... Duncan's got the bonnet on. We don't want to upset Duncan anymore. He's going to go in deep for us in the world of Jane Austen. We're going to very much look forward to the results. Our email is janeandfee@times.radio. Our WhatsApp is 0333 003 2353. Coming up, we're going to talk about the $10 billion BBC lawsuit that just isn't going away. You're listening to Fee Glover and Roy Anika on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
The Times and the Sunday Times Christmas Charity Appeal 2025. This Christmas, the Times and the Sunday Times are supporting World Bicycle Relief. Operating in 28 countries, World Bicycle Relief provide bicycles, parts and mechanical training to people that would otherwise be unable to go to school, find medical treatment or operate businesses. To find out more and donate to any or all of our nominated charities, search Times Charity Appeal now. Thank you.
What good is sitting alone?
Winning a record-breaking 7 Olivier Awards, Cabaret at the Kit Kat Club is still the best musical in London, says the Daily Telegraph.
Life is a cabaret, old chum.
The most electrifying night out starts the minute you step inside. Outside it is winter, but in here it is so hot. So right this way, your stage-side table is waiting. Book your tickets for a perfectly marvellous gift this Christmas at kitkat.club.
Christmas was a tough time in my family. I became homeless as an adult. I had to turn to a food bank.
This Christmas, your gift to Trussell could help provide emergency food and expert advice. For people like Aaron, it'll be a lifeline.
This Christmas, my dream is that people leave the food bank with hope.
If you can, please give to Trussell today. You can help food banks provide an emergency food parcel and support someone facing hunger this winter. Search Trussell today.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix. Looking for inspiration for your new kitchen? Let Wix help you find brilliant kitchen ideas. Browse the Wix Kitchen Gallery or try the Matchmaker tool to find a style that suits you. Find the gallery and matchmaker at wix.co.uk.
Now, if you'd like to be in with a chance of winning a DAB radio, then have a go at the Times' Radio's Daily Quiz. We play Can You Get to Number 10 every Monday to Thursday just before 1pm. It's 10 general knowledge questions for 10 jobs in Hugo Rifkin's cabinet. And if you can get all the way to the top, you become Prime Minister and you win a Times Radio branded DAB radio. If you'd like to take part, you can email studio@times.radio.
It's well worth it. It's always a very, very good listen. You can employ Larry the cat.
Love Larry.
Who gives you a little bit of a clue, which always helps people on their way. Do get involved if you can. 19 minutes past three. The BBC has vowed to defend itself after Donald Trump filed his £10 billion lawsuit against the broadcaster. The president alleged the BBC intentionally, maliciously and deceptively edited the speech he gave before the attack on the US Capitol on the 6th of January 2020. Let's talk now to Anna Sabine, culture, media and sports spokesperson for the Liberal Democrats. A very good afternoon from us. I know you've got thoughts about what the response should be to this. What are you hoping for?
Well, the Lib Dems are hoping that the government, and Keir Starmer in particular, is actually going to step up and defend our national broadcaster. I think the BBC is absolutely right in saying it's going to defend it, but it needs some cover from the government. And although the government are kind of saying nice things, they're not really going to Donald Trump. We've yet to see Keir Starmer pick up the phone to Donald Trump and say, can you back off? This is our national broadcaster. We're a democratically elected country. Your job shouldn't be to interfere in our broadcaster and our free speech. We need you to pull the suit. Even if the suit doesn't go much further, it's already costing so much time for the taxpayer and the licence fee payer in terms of staff time, lawyer time. It's just unacceptable.
Might there be a possibility that Keir Starmer is trying to play his own game with this, whereby he is allowing President Trump his time in the sun to be the victim of a bad edit, and that is the truth, it was a bad edit, and thereby he might be able to win out in the end. It might not come to a court in Florida.
think you might be ascribing more credit to Keir Starmer's powers of strategy than there are. But if that were the case, I might have brought that up to today. I might have said, well, they're going to let him shout about bringing a lawsuit and then nothing happens and it all quietens down. But the fact that he's doubled down on it today suggests to me that he's not listening and that strategy isn't working. And what we need is for the government, particularly at a time when we've got charter review coming up, the Green Paper's just come out on that today. We need our national government to really seriously defend something that's the jewel in the crown of our cultural institutions and say, back off, the BBC is ours, it's owned by the British taxpayer, and you can't go around behaving like this because you don't like something that happened.
He does have to accept, and by he, I mean Keir Starmer here, though, that you know, he's a lawyer. He knows that he can't protest innocence in this. This is the problem, isn't it? And ultimately, Donald Trump, he may win a case in Florida. It may not be $10 billion, but he might just have to get his day in court. A crime, maybe you want to put that in inverted commas, has been committed.
I mean, I'm not a lawyer, and I would argue that what we need from Keir Starmer is not a lawyer. We need a leader, and that's exactly the problem he's having across politics. We're seeing absolutely zero leadership here. He doesn't need to be the BBC's lawyer. He needs to be the leader of this country and defend something that many British people hold really dear. The lawyers suggest that there's actually not very much evidence of defamation because you've got to prove that it basically came out in the US, and the BBC isn't screened in the US unless you're looking at it on an iPlayer and you've got a VPN. So there's very limited evidence that anyone's actually seen it in the US and that you can therefore prove defamation. This really is all about Trump kind of thrusting left, right and centre, showing everyone who's boss. And there was an argument, another kind of strategy argument, was that, well, we have to keep Trump on side because that way we're going to get these great trade deals. We also hear today that he's putting on ice this multi-billion pound investment on tech into the UK because he's not happy with us about that. He behaves like a bully. And what we need Starmer to do is to stand up and behave like someone who's defending his country against bullying. And that's what's not happening from the government.
Do you think that maybe Keir Starmer and his advisers just think exactly to the point you've just made, that actually Trump would lose this case?
Even if he loses the case, we will lose so much money over trying to defend it, over the cost involved, over the distraction at the BBC ahead of a time when we should be looking to its long-term future. It's not acceptable, but it's also about something bigger than that. And I go back to this Love Actually Hugh Grant thing. You know, Trump is behaving like Billy Bob Thornton, and we need a Hugh Grant right now. We need someone to stand up and say, we're not having it, that you're going to have a go at the BBC. The BBC's ours, and if we're cross with it, we're allowed to be cross with it. But you can't make this crazy claim about the amount of damages that you need and expect that to be taken seriously. Back off. And the argument about him being a better ally to us if we let this run isn't working. I actually think Trump would respond better to people being tougher with him than with this kind of kowtowing that's happening at the moment.
If a US court did rule that the BBC should pay out over a programme that didn't even air in the US, should it comply?
I hope to goodness that it wouldn't come to that. And I hope that we wouldn't get there. And I'm not a lawyer, so I don't feel comfortable commenting on whether it should comply or not. But I do know that what the Lib Dems want to make sure is that British taxpayers and licence fee payers are not footing the bill in a cost of living crisis for Trump having a very, very thin skin.
The BBC has got to change, hasn't it? And the Green Paper on Future Funding has now been launched. It gives us all a 12-week consultation period on funding options. Adverts will be considered, subscriptions, maybe means testing. What would you be happy to see in the future?
I have just picked up my copy of the Green Paper, which I need to go away and read over Christmas before I give a kind of official party response. But we're very clear that we want to see a long-term sustainable public funding for the BBC. We don't want it to rely solely on a subscription-based model. It's got to be something the BBC can rely on, particularly in a time of huge political turbulence. And the governance has got to change such that it's removed from political interference. We need non-political appointments and appointing processes. And we need the BBC to be able to defend itself against whatever political future we might find ourselves in.
That is fun times at your house over the festive season.
It really is. Yeah, I'm a big, big fun person.
Happy Christmas to you.
Thanks
and your Green
so
Paper. Anna Sabine, media spokesperson for the Liberal Democrats. Well, let's talk now to Dorothy Byrne, the former head of news and current affairs for Channel 4. She is now president of Murray Edwards College at Cambridge University. Dorothy, what do you think the chances are of Donald Trump winning this case in a US court? You know your defamation laws very well. He's got a hard case to prove, hasn't he?
Well, of course, a defamation case in the United States is different to one in the UK. But there are two specific things he has said in his claim that I think will be hard to prove. and they are that it was intentional and it was malicious. So far, the evidence we have is that there were no fewer than 6 BBC executives who watched this programme before it went on air. We might wonder why so many. And none of them spotted that there even was an edit. So if you didn't spot there even was an edit, it's very hard to see how you were intentional or malicious in what you did. They obviously made a mistake. We also have to ask ourselves, how damaging was that mistake to Donald Trump in view of the fact that he won the election and he is a man who often says very straightforward and remarkable things?
You're absolutely right. This programme wasn't shown on any major network in America. I mean, to be fair, it wasn't even watched by that many people in this country or complained about at the time. But can you see the argument that actually Donald Trump wants the spectacle to continue, doesn't he? In a sense, he wins even if he loses in court. We're talking about this now. He's got another platform with which to deride a public service broadcaster.
Well, it's not a happy day for the BBC, is it, as this matter drags on further? You could argue that they are being punished just by the case alone being threatened. It is not good for the BBC, but that doesn't mean that the BBC should just pay him off the way that some US broadcasters have paid him off when they have been threatened with huge cases, because that was the income of a large commercial organisation, whereas here, any money that the BBC paid would be fundamentally your money and my money, licence fee payers' money. And I don't think it's really easy for the BBC to say, we'll give Donald Trump £10 or £15 million of licence fee payers' money to persuade him to give up his case.
I mean, I agree, Dorothy, and I think, you know, it will just be such an extraordinary thing if, you know, maybe we speak in a year's time and all of us have spent a whole year's licence fee paying off a court case in America. But I wonder whether you think that Keir Starmer can use that argument effectively with Donald Trump. You heard our previous guest talking on behalf of the Liberal Democrats wanting Sir Keir to really put his fists up over this. But, I mean, that's no guarantee that you change the mind of Donald Trump. What would you do?
Well, it is no guarantee. And we shouldn't forget as well that the BBC is independent, or supposed to be independent, of the government. Is it really right for the leader of one country to beg the leader of another country not to take legal action against a supposedly independent organisation? I don't think the issue is as simple as your previous speaker implied it was. I think it begs lots of questions itself if Keir Starmer starts to speak for the BBC.
Well, I'm sure we'll speak again on this, Dorothy. Thank you very much indeed for your time this afternoon. That is Dorothy Byrne, former head of news and current affairs for Channel 4.
Coming up, our big interview is with a trailblazing Formula One driver, and she's a woman. But first, let's get a check on the latest news with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. A man's been sentenced to 21 years and 6 months for ploughing his car into crowds at Liverpool's Premier League victory parade. 134 people were injured, including babies and children, after Paul Doyle drove over limbs and crushed prams. The former Royal Marine was in tears as Judge Andrew Menery KC told him he'll serve at least two-thirds of the sentence.
It is almost impossible to comprehend how any right-thinking person could act as you did. to drive a vehicle into crowds of pedestrians with such persistence and disregard for human life defies ordinary understanding.
A teenage boy has been arrested on suspicion of murdering a 9-year-old girl in Somerset. Officers were called to an address in Weston-super-Mare last night. One of Stephen Lawrence's killers has been denied parole. David Norris admitted his involvement in the teenager's racist murder for the first time in October, though refused to reveal who else took part. An independent review is going to look at how foreign money is influencing UK politics. It comes after ex-UKIP and Reform UK politician Nathan Gill was jailed for accepting bribes linked to Russia. And the BBC has confirmed it'll defend itself against Donald Trump, who's suing over an edit in a documentary. The US president claims he was portrayed in a defamatory, deceptive and malicious manner. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
This is Times Radio.
Cancer Research UK is funding the breakthroughs that matter. Did you know that over the past 50 years, their work has helped double cancer survival in the UK? Cancer Research UK science expert Dr. Sam Godfrey talks about the breakthroughs that could change the lives of people affected by cancer.
One of the breakthroughs that I'm so excited about is that our scientists discovered that the human papillomavirus actually caused almost all cervical cancers and a number of other cancers too. This has meant we've been able to develop a vaccine, and that is now expected to prevent almost 90% of cervical cancers in the UK. With screening as well, we think we're going to get to a point where we can stop almost all cervical cancers, and we're going to see a future where cervical cancer is effectively eradicated. It's such an exciting thing, and it just scratches the surface of what really is the golden age of research.
Witness more incredible research breakthroughs in Cancer Detectives Finding the Cures, brought to you by Cancer Research UK. Stream now on Channel 4. Cancer Research UK is a registered UK charity.
Get ahead of the news with Kate Borsay from 7pm as she brings you Tomorrow's Times Today. An exclusive look at the stories making tomorrow's headlines.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles at Wix. There's a kitchen to suit every home, with prices starting from under £3,000. Start planning your new kitchen. Book a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Now, Susie Wolfe is part of Formula One royalty. She is a groundbreaker and a pace setter, the first woman to drive Formula One. Her practice session in 2014 was not to turn into a full place on the track, though. That still eludes a female driver, but it is something that the F1 Academy, a female racing series set up and run by Wolfe, aims to sort out. And Susie is certain that we will see a woman on the podium in the next decade. Now, Susie herself hails from the west coast of Scotland, from a family that encouraged her to ride bikes and then drive, a path she only veered from the once when she got a place at Edinburgh University to read international business. She only lasted a couple of weeks because she simply missed being on a track. She went on to race in the DTM, that's the German Masters, became a Williams development driver and came within reach of a Grand Prix in 2015 when a driver, Bottas, was injured. But she was passed over in favour of a male driver, and it led to her decision to retire. She's married to Toto Wolff, the team principal at Mercedes. They've got a son. They are Austrian. You can hear the Austrian influence in her Argyll and Bute tones these days. Her memoir is called Driven, and she starts the book with her experience of driving F1 for the first time. So I asked Susie to take us to that point.
It was such an important day because it was a dream that I'd hung on to since I was a 13-year-old girl. And I really wanted to bring that moment alive in the book, to bring people into a Formula One car, to understand what goes on in behind the scenes. Because even getting a Formula One car out of the pit garage with all of the technology and electronics is quite a feat. And then getting out on track, you've done days in a simulator, you're well prepared, but nothing is like the speed that you feel out on track. And the difficulty with a Formula One car is the downforce. You know, with downforce, the faster you go, the more grip you have. So it's really counterintuitive. But I had been put through my paces by Williams. I knew exactly what I had to achieve on that day. And as much as it was exhilarating in one sense, finally driving an F1 car, realizing just what it feels like to go at that speed, it was also a moment where I was just hyper-focused. I knew every detail. I'd done it so many times in my head that it somehow felt familiar.
Can you put into context what an extraordinary thing it was for a woman to be doing that?
Well, motorsport is one of the few sports in the world that isn't segregated, but participation of female drivers has never gone above 5%. We really are a minority. And of course, F1 is a pinnacle of the sport, so we've never really seen since the 1980s any women in Formula One. And I'd never set out on a quest to be a woman that made it to F1. I was simply a young girl that was hugely competitive, loved speed, loved the adrenaline, and luckily had the family background around me, which allowed me to follow the path of racing and then having a dream of making it to F1. But of course, when I got in the F1 car, and it was only ever supposed to be 25 laps, there was so much attention from the media that a woman was back in an F1 car. Would I be physically fit enough to drive a modern day F1 car? Would I be quick? And it was that actual publicity and all of that, let's say, noise around my gender, which led to me being given a space in the team. Because the team, you know, the test was in November. The team already had their lineup of drivers, but the CEO of Williams at the time created a role which is now commonplace in F1 for me, called a development driver. And suddenly I had my foot in the door, which was incredible at the time.
What would prevent women from performing to the same level as men if there wasn't sexism and prejudice around? Is there something about a woman's body, a woman's stature, the way a car is built, that is adding to this problem of getting to equality on the track?
Well, women have 30% less muscle than men, and I'm not naive enough to think that that can be overcome with sheer grit. But in a racing car, particularly in a Formula One car, it doesn't come down to pure muscle. And if you look at our current world, newly crowned world champion, Lando Norris, he's not a big, huge, muscly man. So actually being smaller and lighter is advantageous. So I don't believe that there's any reason a woman can't compete in Formula One. I drove an F1 car. I did a race distance at Barcelona. I know it's possible. I think what we need to break down is the preconceptions of the sport. It's still seen as quite male-dominated, quite macho, but it's changing. And the global F1 fan base is now 42% female, the fastest-growing fan demographic, the 18 to 24-year-old female. How lucky we are. And now we have F1 Academy, which I run for F1. It's an all-female race series to help identify young female talent and help them find their way upwards in the sport. And there's never been so much opportunity for women in the sport now. And I do think there's still a lot to be done, but I do think the sport has transformed from when I was racing.
We will come back and talk more about all of those things, but I also want you to tell us a little bit more about your childhood, because your mum had a saying, didn't she? Full throttle, don't stop. Which I think is, I mean, on the one hand, how blooming fantastic, but on the other hand, it's quite it's counterintuitive to the way an awful lot of people parent, isn't it, Susie?
I grew up on the west coast of Scotland, and when I was writing Driven, now as a mother, so much appreciation for my childhood and how my parents brought me up, because they instilled in me that belief. And I was a little girl with such big dreams. And I look back now and think, where did all that self-belief come from? Where did those big dreams? But they instilled that in me. They gave me the opportunities. They always led me to believe anything my brother could achieve, I could achieve. There was no differentiation between son and daughter. And my mum recognised my character. I always had to be kept busy. I wasn't someone that could, you know, laze around. And so she kept me busy, and it really was full throttle all the way.
And wheels are in your family, aren't they?
Yes, the history is more on two wheels. But thankfully, my dad said, who runs a motorbike shop together with my mum, two wheels was too dangerous for his little girl, so he put me in a go-kart instead of a motorbike. And that really set me off on the path.
Tell me a little bit more about what changes when you are a mother yourself. Because, you know, the motorsport world has often been dominated by tragedy. It's such a dangerous thing that you're going into. I understand that there are guardrails of safety put there for you, but it's not for the faint-hearted, is it?
It's definitely not, but I would also argue that it's not all-out risk. The sport has become very safe over the years. Of course, there's still, unfortunately, tragedies, but I believe that there's many sports where injury or something can happen. But I do think the speeds that we're taking out on track in motorsport generally means it's quite frightening to watch. You know, my son's just started racing, so now suddenly I know what my parents went through. But when I became a mother, I'd already retired from racing. I didn't retire to become a mother. But certainly, I think when you become a parent, are you willing to risk everything anymore when you know someone is relying on you as much as a son or a daughter does? Probably not. So glad that I had retired from racing when I became a mother.
Tell me a bit more about the F1 Academy then, how it got set up and where it is now.
Well, credit to F1. I think they recognised this growing female fan base that the sport has, and they wanted to give opportunity to young women, because motorsport has a high financial barrier to entry, unlike football, tennis or basketball, where you literally need a court and a ball that you can practice. You need money to go racing, even if it's as simple as going to your local kart track. It still costs money.
And most of the all-time greats come from money, don't they? So, I mean, it is a simple fact. They're backed by huge bank accounts, bank of mum and dad or whatever.
In some circumstances, yes. But then you look at Lewis Hamilton, probably the greatest of all time in our sport, and not from a hugely affluent background. So you like to think that talent will find its way, it will rise to the top no matter the circumstance. But I think the fact that this high financial barrier is there in the sport, and then the perception of the sport is still so male-dominated that we just don't have enough young women entering the sport. So F1 had this concept of F1 Academy to really increase the pipeline of young female talent. We cover nearly all the funding for a young driver to race in F1 Academy, which is an all-female race series. We race with F1 on seven Grand Prix race weekends, normally a couple of hours before the Grand Prix starts. And we have the 10 Formula One teams on board. So you have young women in a Red Bull, McLaren, Mercedes, Ferrari race suit out on track in an F4 car, which is like a miniature F1 car. And that is not just a huge opportunity for them, but such a strong inspiration for the next generation. Because sometimes in life you have to see it to believe it. And we see there's just more young women turning up at kart tracks now because they see what's possible with F1 Academy.
And presumably you have been lifted up by the enormous success of women's football, of women's rugby, of women's cricket. Because apart from anything else, Susie, I mean, this is such an obvious thing that you already know, where money and success meet is a very happy place for sport. And presumably, motor racing benefits from having seen the advertising flood into those sports now that women are doing incredibly well and pulling in the crowds.
Well, I definitely dived into that in my book, because I think we're at a very important crossroad where women's sport has broken through. Huge opportunity. And luckily for us, F1 put a lot of investment to build F1 Academy up. And like you rightly said, when that investment meets the opportunity, suddenly so much momentum. And that's just wonderful to see.
When do you think it means that we will be able to see in reality the dream that you had when you were a young girl, a podium full of women and not being kind of questioned for being there?
I think it will take some years because we've got to really build up the pipeline of talent. But if we do a good job with F1 Academy, it will be inevitable because there'll be so many more talented young women racing, more young women in the sport. To your point, it will be not special to be a woman in the sport anymore. It will just be, well, she is an engineer or a strategist or a driver rather than a female driver or a female strategist. So we've got to do a very good job at the foundation, which I think we're on a good way. And it will be inevitable. Will it be 5, 8, 10 years? I can't tell you exactly, but I think it will definitely happen.
There is a problem in society with sexism towards women, with men taking advantage of women. And actually, do you know what, Susie? It is
it is almost rare to interview very successful women who've written their memoirs without having to refer to some incident in their life where they have been vulnerable to unwanted male attention. You have that experience yourself. So I wonder whether you'd mind telling us a little bit about that. And also, what we do about it, it is so exhausting to constantly have to talk about it, isn't it? And I don't have to ask the same question of a successful man who's written a memoir. I really don't, or very, very rarely.
It's frustrating to hear that. It was really important for me to put it in the book. I didn't want the book to just be all of the shiny, rosy parts of my journey, because they were very tough moments throughout the journey. And that was one of them, where I was petrified. And to your point, I also know so many friends and women who have had to have those experiences. And I was very fortunate that the person didn't get into my room. And
so you were at a corporate gig, weren't you?
I was at the end of your Christmas party for Mercedes, and I didn't go to the bar. I didn't drink because I was obviously a driver. And I was in my room, and at 2 o'clock, the phone kept ringing. I pulled off off the wall, and then the knocking on the door started. And it was that split second, what am I going to do if that door opens? But it didn't open. And when I turned up to the first F1 Grand Prix in Melbourne the following year, the person immediately apologised. So I'm grateful that my experience was okay, but I'm well aware that for many, it doesn't turn out like that, and it's truly frightening. And I think the more we can speak about it, the more we can recognise that it still happens, the more we can force environments and industries to be more aware and to create a situation where if something does happen, a woman can put her hand up and say, listen, this happened, that she'll be listened to, that it'll be recognised.
Do you think that F1 might have more of a problem than other sports, though? Because it does have a very kind of... it's got a macho top note, hasn't it?
It does. I mean, we're trying our best with F1 Academy to disrupt, to challenge the perceptions that it's a macho world, because I think it has changed. And real credit to Stefano Domenicali, the CEO, and those within F1, because there has been a real effort made. And let's not forget, the world's changed. Society has also changed. The Me Too movement has meant people, teams, industries have to be more aware of what is going on. So I think that's been a step in the right direction. But we still need to do more. Of course we do. We have to make sure that it's a situation where it just can't happen anymore. But I do think in many instances, it comes down to individuals more than the sport as a whole. And we just need to make sure that it over time comes to the point where it's just completely unacceptable.
May I ask what your husband thought of that incident? I mean, he's an incredibly important figure in Formula One, and you presumably have told him who this guy was. Does Toto Wolff still have to come across him and, you know, sit at a table with him and do business with him?
No, he doesn't, because it was a different time. But I think there's a lot to be said of, as a woman, who you choose to partner in your life with, who you choose to marry or spend your life with, plays such an important part as to how your journey will unfold. And I was incredibly lucky that I have a husband that supports me 100%. And he's tough. You know, he doesn't shy away if he doesn't think something is good enough.
You surprise me, Susie.
So he doesn't wrap me in cotton wool, but he loves to see me go out and do my own thing and to succeed. And he's definitely always in my corner, and that's something I don't underestimate as to being so important, because sometimes being a wife and a mother, it's a huge juggle, and then on top trying to keep your own ambitions alive and keep your own journey of improvement and discovery, that's sometimes tough, and he definitely supports me a lot.
Sometimes it has been difficult, though, hasn't it, for both of you professionally, because you are husband and wife. So there was a conflict of interest point raised, wasn't there, against you running the F1 Academy that I know had a huge pushback immediately from the teams, didn't it? Can you tell us a bit more about what happened there?
It was a very unfortunate situation, because the reality is we both work in the same sport, but F1 Academy has nothing to do with F1. You know, it's run as its own series, but out came this accusation, and to your point, very quickly, all the teams united to say, well, they didn't have an issue with it, which I found, well, which really touched me at the time, because they don't normally do that. But I think they had recognised what momentum F1 Academy was having, how passionate I was about trying to make a positive difference. So it very quickly got dropped without there having been any investigating. And it was a moment that left a sour taste in my mouth, because there was no foundation for it. There was no investigating. And it just, after creating 600 articles online, was suddenly dropped and not spoken about again.
Yep. Do you have any points on your normal driving licence, Susie Wolf?
Well, I've lost my licence before. Because let's just say I'm not always aware of just how quick I am driving, which can be dangerous and very expensive. So to your point, right now I'm in a good spot, but well, I done. Have been in difficulty in the past.
What does super speed actually feel like? Because most of us won't have driven over, I daren't go over about 65 miles an hour. I'm gripping the steering wheel if I do, Susie. So the notion that your body could be in a machine going at, what would your maximum speed have been?
Just over 300 kilometres an hour.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Okay, what does, what does it feel like?
I mean, it's difficult for someone to explain to someone that doesn't like speed, because I love the feeling of speed, whether I'm
okay, pretend I'm a different person.
Okay, well, even if I'm on a mountain skiing or in a car, I just love the acceleration that you get from going fast, the adrenaline that surges through you. And when you're competing, then the dancing on the edge of what's possible in a racing car. That's the grip from the tyre and the cornering. And for me, it's one of the best feelings in the world, but clearly you need to like speed.
You are quite a slender woman as well, aren't you? And I know that you mentioned in the book a couple of times your neck is quite vulnerable, isn't it, when you're going at a huge speed like that. What can you do to protect yourself more? Does it matter that you're a slender person?
It's actually advantageous in racing. And if you look at, like we mentioned, the F1 drivers, you can't be big, you can't really be tall, because this is so compact in the car. So every kilo that you can give back to the engineers, because the car with driver has to be a certain weight, that can be very, very advantageous. So most drivers are always on a diet or having to be very careful of what they eat, a bit like a jockey. And my build was, in that sense, advantageous in that I didn't have the extra kilos, and it didn't count against me in performance.
But what's happening to your neck when you're driving at speed? Why is your neck so vulnerable?
Because you're strapped, the seat is carbon fibre built to your exact proportions, and you're so tightly strapped in that the only thing which isn't strapped down is your neck, and it takes the huge G-force. I mean, one G is double your own body weight. Under braking at the end of the straight in an F1 car, you'll hit around 4.5 G. So that's a huge amount of what feels like weight pressing on the back of your head. And then when you're cornering, on the sides of your neck muscles. But the great thing is neck muscles are small. They can be built up quickly. I had always a huge neck because it got built up over so many years. But the minute I stopped racing, because the muscles are so small, it quite quickly shrunk. But I was proud of that neck. It held me in good stead in many moments of my career.
Good for you, girlfriend. You're wearing a polo neck today. So
only because it's a bit chilly.
No, I'm thinking she's still got the amazing neck. A couple of quickfire questions, if I may, for people who are listening who would just like your opinion on current Grand Prix and Formula One news. Lando Norris, would you like to tell us your thoughts about him?
Very deserving world champion, and very good for me that he showed you do it your own way. You don't need to conform to what an ideal is of what a champion is. He's very different to Max, but he won it on his terms and showed that you be you, you stay authentic to who you are, and it's still possible.
New regulations in Formula One, what will they mean?
Exciting. Everyone's starting from a blank sheet of paper. Who will have got it right? Who will have missed something? There are going to be a lot of nervous people in Formula One the last week of January when those cars hit the track for the first time.
And can you give us a name from someone who you're familiar with in your academy who we should really, really watch out for, who might be as groundbreaking in the sport as you've been?
Difficult to say just one, because I see many coming through.
You may do a couple, but only because it's Christmas.
Okay. Well, I'll do their first names so that then it doesn't look like I'm singling them out. There's a young girl who will be out in F1 Academy for Ferrari next year, Alba Larson. Red Bull have an outstanding young British driver, Alicia. So definitely some talents that really fill me with hope for the future.
That's Susie Wolf, and her book is called Driven.
Absolutely beautiful Austrian Scottish lilt. It's 3:56. This is Fee Glover and Woronika on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts. I am so looking forward to Christmas. I absolutely love everything about it. Decorating the tree, wrapping the presents. For us, it's always been a big family get-together. Me, Mike, the kids, my sister Julie, and all her family too. We all go back home to Mum and Dad's house. It's a bit of a squeeze these days, but Mum and Dad are both in their 80s now, and it's really important that we all go where we've always gone for Christmas. It just wouldn't be the same any other way. Thankfully, this year we have Carol, Mum and Dad's lovely care professional, from Home Instead. Home Instead are amazing. I honestly don't know what we'd do without them. Carol comes and visits in the week when we're all busy at work and makes sure that Mum and Dad have everything they need. Obviously, this year we've all offered to help with preparing the Christmas dinner, but Mum absolutely insists that she's got it all under control. Which means Carol has.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
This is Times Radio.
And that's almost it from us for today. I'll be back tomorrow from 2 with Rosie Wright. You can hear even more of us on our daily podcast, Off Air with Jane and Fee, available wherever you get your podcasts from. At the moment, Eve and I are chuntering our way through the podcast with plenty of email additions. We're talking about lodgers. We're always talking about accents. We're talking about Christmas, and we're talking about young Eve's potential life, which was to be lived in a dance troupe. But sadly, it was cut short. To find out more, just log on to Off Air with Jane and Fee. Roy, thank you for your company over the last couple of days.
Always a pleasure.
You now return to your day job?
Yes, I will return to my day job, and that royal family, the gift that keeps giving.
It does, many scoops.
Yes.
And do you feel in your waters it will be a quiet Christmas?
I really hope so, Fee, but it's always famous last words when you say that. So I'm going to try and have no thoughts at all and hope for no crises and no major headlines in that lovely quiet time.
Okay, good luck with that.
Thanks.
So we'll speak again over the Christmas season in a news-type concept.
No.
Our producer today was Felix Forbes. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. Andrew Billen is our guest after 3:30 tomorrow to talk about his best interviews of the year and also to talk about those we've lost from the worlds of culture and show business. Up next, it's John Pienaar with Drive. Enjoy your evening when you get to it.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Roy. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. A man has been sentenced to 21 years and 6 months for ploughing his car into crowds at Liverpool Premier League victory parade. And an independent review is going to look at how foreign money is influencing UK politics. Coming up, the US has put a tech deal with the UK on ice. So what does it leave our businesses, our economy, our relationship with the White House? We're going to be looking at that. And behind the scenes of our diplomacy, really comes without a business deal under the Donald Trump administration. I'll also be talking to an NHS trust boss preparing for the resident doctor's walkout from tomorrow morning.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. A 54-year-old man has been sentenced to 21 and a half years in prison for driving into crowds at Liverpool's Victory Parade in May, injuring more than 130 people. A judge said Paul Doyle caused utter devastation on what should have been a day of celebration. The attack was only stopped when former soldier Daniel Barr climbed into the back seat and grabbed the gear stick.
I do recall seeing that he had an automatic, so I thought, like, just jam that forward as far as you can. That should stop him.
Prosecutors describe his intervention as truly heroic. A teenage boy has been arrested on suspicion of murdering a 9-year-old girl in Somerset. Officers were called to an address in Weston-super-Mare last night. The mother of murdered teenager Stephen Lawrence has urged police to interview one of his killers again to push him to name the other murderers. David Norris has been denied parole. Stephen was murdered by a gang of racists in 1993, only two of whom, David Norris and Gary Dobson, have ever been brought to justice. In a statement, Doreen Lawrence said justice is still possible, but the Met has made no effort to follow up on the admission Norris made. The Prime Minister has launched an urgent review into the extent of foreign interference in British politics. It comes after the former leader of Reform UK in Wales, Nathan Gill, was jailed for accepting tens of thousands of pounds in cash to make pro-Russian statements to the media and European Parliament. The investigation will be led by Philip Rycroft, the former permanent secretary of the Brexit Department. The Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy, has put forward new proposals for the BBC licence fee. It could pave the way to run adverts and launch a Netflix-style subscription service. Launching the process to renew the BBC's charter for the next 10 years from 2028, the Culture Secretary compared the corporation to the NHS. Roger Mosey, the former director of BBC TV News, hasn't heard anything yet that could work.
Most people think advertising doesn't work because advertising actually erodes the television base of ITV and Channel 4. And subscription has the big problem that either you put things behind a paywall or you put everything in a public service domain, in which case there isn't anything that drives subscription. So I hope the government will stick by the idea it needs to fund the BBC, but I'm not sure these ideas take us very much forward today. And the key thing is the consultation that's about to start.
The BBC, meanwhile, says it will fight a defamation case brought by Donald Trump that could cost the corporation billions of pounds. It claims a Panorama programme edited clips from 2021 to make it look like he urged supporters to fight at the US Capitol. And police in Australia say one of the suspects in the Bondi Beach shooting has now woken from a coma. They think 24-year-old Naveed Akram and his father, who was shot dead, were inspired by Islamic State. 15 people were killed at the Hanukkah event. The youngest was 10-year-old Matilda. Her brother spoke to crowds at a memorial service.
Whenever I would ask Matilda if she knew that I loved her, she would immediately say yes. She knew she was loved. She wasn't alone.
And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, John Pienaar, at Drive, on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Do you remember, in September, during Donald Trump's official visit, Keir Starmer sitting in a specially erected and decorated marquee at Chequers, surrounded by billionaire tech barons, Prime Minister visibly delighted to announce a £31 billion UK-US tech investment deal. And why not? Well, it didn't last long. The Trump administration has put the deal on ice and is now demanding trade concessions to revive it. Concessions from lower food standards for US imports to looser tech regulation and lower digital taxes. The government says it's simply Washington playing hardball, and that's clearly true. It's also a display of American economic muscle when dealing with a trade partner in a vulnerable position, in this case, of course, Britain. A reality check, and a hard one. I'll have more on that story for you in a moment. Wonder what you're thinking about this. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. We can first of all welcome and say good afternoon to Oliver Wright, the Times policy editor. Hello to you, Oliver.
Hello.
Ollie, so first of all, this tech prosperity deal, as it was called, just tell us what it was, essentially.
It was basically an agreement
for the United States and the UK to cooperate on cutting-edge technology, whether that be quantum computing, whether that could be AI and investment in the UK. And it was a sort of framework of understanding. It wasn't terribly concrete, but it was basically the two countries saying, look, this is the future and we're going to work together on the future. And obviously, people will remember it came during Donald Trump's state visit, and it was coupled with some pretty significant announcements of investment by companies like Microsoft in the UK.
Yeah, and we remember on that day, the Prime Minister, there was so much fanfare, the Prime Minister and Downing Street, they believed they had a deal and they attached huge importance to it, didn't they? They couldn't really have overstated the importance in their eye. It was about defining the Britain's place in the global tech economy.
No, absolutely. And it was, as you said, the centrepiece of it. And it was a sort of justification for the state visit. And it was something that Peter Mandelson, when he was US ambassador, worked a lot on to try and get the details of that deal ready in time for the state visit. Obviously, he wasn't in post to see it through, but he was one of the authors of it.
What's the thinking in Downing Street, as far as you can pick it up, Ollie, and what they really think about this? I mean, from what I've read and what I've heard, Downing Street are putting on a brave front, which is what you might expect. They're saying, no, this is a hard ball in trade relations, normal business. But they are under sudden pressure, which one assumes they would not have anticipated in quite the way that it's come.
Yeah, I mean, I think the central point to all this is if you actually sort of go back even further back from beyond the state visit to when Trump and Starmer announced this trade deal first off, and it was the impression was very much given that this was a deal that had been done, and people said this is the United States' first proper trade deal under Donald Trump. Now, the point is, it wasn't a trade deal. There were a few concrete announcements in it, but there were whole swathes of areas where it was just, we will discuss this more. Mm. And the problem what we've got at the moment is on things like this sort of prosperity deal, it is being tied up in other elements of the trade deal which have yet to be agreed. In particular, the US side are pretty unhappy with UK regulation. They don't like the idea that we're going to align with the EU. They want to have more market access for American produce. And, I don't think you can forget that the midterm elections are coming up in the States. Farmers are a key constituency of Donald Trump. And to try and extract concessions from the UK side on things like sort of American exports is quite important domestically for the president.
Yes. And on this side, on the British side, it's going to be uncomfortable because we're talking about areas where there are or have been and still are, I think, still pretty strong red lines. We're talking about food standards. I mean, for many years, Britain and British ministers have sworn to uphold food standards in pretty much their current state.